everybody, and welcome to another episode of Horror Movie Night. This week, we are talking about 1995's Tales from the Hood. This was the anthology film that I picked. And here's the thing. I'm very nervous about how this is going to go because I'm going to be totally transparent. This is my favorite anthology film. I feel like it's got some amazing kills. It's got some fun special effects. I think all the stories work. I think the wraparound story is great. And I think that it is still as socially relevant in 2019 as it was in 1995 when it was released, if not more so. What I'm afraid of is A, that both of my co-hosts will disagree with me, and B, that we're going to have a real hard time being funny about such serious subjects. But I have faith in us, guys. I really, truly do. So how about you just break my heart right now? Let me know if you hated this movie or not.
I didn't hate it. I personally, and this is like, feel really shitty saying this because of who I am and my entire background, but my only thing is like it was good. It had a great message. It was deep. I go to horror to avoid those things, you know what I mean? Like I go to horror just to watch like mindless deaths for the most part.
Right, that's really what our show is about. Yeah. But Brian, was this your first watch
in many years? I watched it way back when, and at the time I was very young, like in high school, very young, but I remember laughing at Matt's like being like, oh, Tales from the Hood, it's such a great, you know, explanation of culture and stuff like that. I'm like, no, it's not. And then I watched it. I was like, oh, now that I understand that this is real.
So this was my first watch because Matt has sung this thing's praises for literally like,
the entire time we've known each other. I've almost picked this on so many occasions, but I'm like, we're just not ready. We're not ready for how well,
and we
this
also
movie is.
We put a moratorium on anthologies until this month. So, yeah. I kept my expectations low, but I really enjoyed it. I think that it's a fantastic film, and I do have a note that even said in all caps, "How is this still relevant?" Which is depressing as shit, but that's just the reality of, you know, Trump's America.
It's one of those things, like I said, it's strange because especially with the name, you go in with low expectations. You're like, all right, Tales from the Hood, because you're thinking of like Snoop Dogg's Hood of Horror, which is just like insulting in every way possible.
Or Bones.
Yeah, or Bones and stuff. Like at this time, a lot of like black horror was not always the best. You know what I mean? Like this is around that time of like People Under the Stairs and like stuff where it felt very condescending more than.
But
sincere.
Also, you know, People Under the Stairs was made by a white man.
Yeah,
who was, you know, I will never defend People Under the Stairs. Sorry, Wes Craven's memory and people that, you know, will defend that movie. Matthew included. I think that movie is absolute garbage just due to the fact that it feels super condescending. It's like a white savior movie, basically.
Of all of the anthology films that we've done up to this point, it's been very easy for me to say, well, this is definitely my favorite and this is definitely my least favorite. But like even my least favorite in this one is still very good. Like it's,
yeah, I don't think that I could pick a least favorite in this because they're all strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's start with the first story.
Well, before we do that, let's make a rule, and try to keep ourselves to it so that we aren't offensive because yeah, we're three white dudes talking about, you know, a lot of racial issues. So no accents, okay?
But really good at them. Hello.
So here we go. We'll try our best. But I am glad that we're finally doing this because I think that there is enough meat on this bone for us to talk about. And we can still have fun talking about the kills and the special effects and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah,
we
will, sure.
We'll try to like not harp too much on social relevance because just watch it. You'll see the social relevance.
I'm absolutely terrified to do this episode.
You'll hear
a lot of editing.
Yeah. I mean, you'll just hear in us explaining the storylines how socially relevant some of this still is. So let's just say we don't need to reiterate it. Listeners will figure it out.
But that gangbanger skeleton at the beginning.
Dude, I love it.
It looks so good.
It looks so, it's such a weirdly captivating intro to this movie, is just a skeleton with a joint in its mouth holding a gun. And just,
and it's got a, like a, you know, a bandana that, I don't know what, is that, is the blue for blood?
No, maybe, I don't,
sorry. I am so fucking white. I'm so sorry.
Well, we'll talk about the whole wraparound thing towards the end, but yes, the intro is great. And I will say that Clarence Williams III is just killing it in these wraparound stories as Mr. Sims. Just so like quirky and strange, and just the way he says the shit.
Like, I like how he's like, oh, the drugs. That's my favorite thing.
But yeah, so the basic wraparound story is three people show up. They're told that there's some drugs that a mortician found and has hidden somewhere in his funeral home. But as they're trying to get to the drugs, they keep getting distracted by different corpses in the funeral home, and he explains what happened to those people. So we dive into the first story, the Rogue Cop Revelation.
Is that their name?
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah, the names on these are rough. The story starts off with a brand new cop. He's a rookie, and he's riding with three white cops, and they pull over someone for what seems like just like a regular pullover. And then it turns out to be kind of like a fictional version of a Martin Luther King or a Malcolm X, someone who speaks out against a lot of corruption, specifically at this point, the corruption of the cops. And while they keep the rookie distracted, the police begin to beat and eventually kill him and make him look like a hypocrite by shooting him up with heroin, so that this guy who was trying to clean up the streets was just as addicted to the drugs on the streets. And then a year later, that person comes back from the dead with the help of the rookie cop and begins to get his vengeance on all of the police that killed him. So a few things jumped out at me when I was watching this. First thing, and one of the only serious things that I'll mention, is that the use of very old jazz and basically a slave song while he's being beaten up was haunting. It was absolutely haunting to use that juxtaposition. But I will also say this segment is one of the most socially relevant movies where someone gets their head smashed against a tombstone while a zombie holds his cock.
Like, we've been having a lot of zombies pulling on dicks lately.
It might be a new favorite trend for me. It's a good trope. But yeah, so the kills in this particular story are fucking fantastic. Like, all three of these cops, when they get killed, it is some gooey, gory, satisfying ends.
I think that my favorite is the syringe.
Yeah, oh my god.
It made me cringe really hard.
Yeah, so one of the cops gets crucified onto a spray painting of a cross with syringes, and then he has a full body melt as he morphs into the wall. Oh my god, now, it looks so good.
I don't think that the body melt looks great. Maybe I'm just I'm still remembering how good the body melt from Necronomicon was, but I think that it's effective. It's just not, you know, since they did CGI, 1995 CGI.
Oh, there's versus, some, listen, there's some CGI we'll in here there, who yeah. is far worse than this one. No, this is one of the better CGI usages. There's also that decapitation, which is fantastic.
Oh, yeah. I love the decapitation because I saw it coming, and even though it's a really cheap effect because they don't actually show anything, you just have the cop's body like come back down into the seat and it's headless. I was still like, this counts as a great decapitation scene because I'm all about those.
Absolutely. But all in all, I would say if I had to pick a least favorite one, this one might be towards the bottom. Just because it is one of the heaviest ones to watch. It hurts in my soul to watch this one.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
But the kills are really good. So the kills keep me going. But like this one, more like the next two or three are much more satisfying in the way that vengeance is taken out.
Well, here's the thing, is that I have a note that says, I was promised fun, Matthew. This is not fun because it's got the police brutality. And I don't know if you really did promise me fun here.
Like, no.
It's Tales from the Hood.
I think the next two have elements of fun. They're still heavy, but they are way more fun than this one. So let's dive into the second one, which, again, like I said, the stories are terribly named. But story number two is called Boys Do Get Bruises.
Which is a much, I think that's a better name than the first one.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. That's probably the worst of the four names. But so Boys Do Get Bruises is something that I feel like I would have seen on an episode of like Beyond Belief. It's got a lot of like the like it's like almost like a Twilight Zone-y type story. But it's about a kid who keeps showing up at school with different types of bruises, and his teacher's really concerned. And one of his classmates tells him that he should draw pictures of everything that scares him, and then he can burn them, and that will destroy the fear. And there's a part that makes me genuinely laugh where the teacher's looking at all the photos, and it's a bunch of monsters, and then it's just the one kid who's been bullying him. And it's like just a really weird cartoon drawing of this kid. And he just goes, yeah, that's Tyrone. Like, he discovers that he actually has the power to, when he crushes the paper of Tyrone, all of a sudden
breaking bones.
Ambulance pulls up and Tyrone has every bone in his body broken. And that's where we have one of the worst actors in the movie, which is the teacher explaining to the main teacher what happened.
Yeah.
He's like,
Matt, Ari,
look, I can't change how the line was delivered, dude. He just said it very direct, and like his delivery was loud and paced out weirdly as if he was reading something verbatim that was written for him.
The only thing that really bothered me about this segment, and I know it's horror, but listen, if you're going to do a horror, you're going to make it relevant and have this raw, real feeling to it. If you are a teacher and you see a kid has bruises and you go up and this kid's really badly bruised and you're like, Billy, what happened? And he's like, a monster did it. You can't just go, all right, well, if you want to be honest, you know where to find me, and then leave. You know what I mean? Investigate that.
I mean, he eventually does. Eventually.
Yeah, he definitely like has a more hands-off approach than you would expect.
Yeah, it's weird. So then you find out that the monster is actually his not stepfather, his mom's
it's
boyfriend.
It's his mom's boyfriend. But yeah. I do have one question about that, because the mom gets painfully close to... So the teacher comes over, he gets shit on by a pigeon, and then I don't know why, but if I were to get shit on by a pigeon, I would just clean that off of my own jacket, probably not while I'm wearing it. But the boy's mom is wiping it off of him, and she gets really close, and it makes you think that she's the monster, but it doesn't make any sense, because she would not. Why would you get that close in proximity and almost kiss your son's teacher when you know that your abusive boyfriend is about to show up?
Yeah, it's weird. And they're like, quote unquote, pseudo romance is not really earned at all in this story. It's not even really necessary in this story.
Oh, yeah, it's totally unnecessary.
But David Alan Grier, who is mostly known for comedy, almost primarily,
yeah,
is fantastic as this just douchebag. You know what I mean? Like, he just walks in, and I think the first thing is he says is like, why do I have to open my own door? Like,
but it's not his house.
It's just this weird, like, right at, with that line alone, you get like this entitlement that he has.
Yeah.
Like,
oh yeah. He's a fucking prick.
You get the vibe of him. And like, there's a scene after the teacher leaves where he storms into the kid's room, and I don't know how they did it, unless it was just CGI or that the actor was wearing like makeup for the upper piece, but it's the kid's perspective, and on the wall is the shadow of a monster coming towards him. But as the shot progresses and then the person comes into frame, it's a person. Mm-hmm. And it's like a very, it's such a cool little effect of showing like the kid's perspective versus reality in
that
one
really
continuous
shot. That
really
was the best part about this whole, I think that the whole setup of the story, it was predictable, but really clever the way that they juxtaposed reality with the kid's reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then we get into the roughest part of this story, which is the fight, because the fight choreography is a little rough. It's just kind of like I'm going to move my hand a little bit and we got to cut because we don't know how to do like the throw punches. So let's just cut as quickly and awkwardly as possible to like not show that we don't know how to choreograph a fight properly. But it leads to my favorite ending of the stories personally, which is that they just start twisting up the paper and it looks so silly, but it still kind of works for me. Just the way that like the arms are bending and his whole body's twisting. And I always love it's very much the Black Knight in Monty Python, the Holy Grail, when he's missing all of his arms, but he still wants to fight, where David Alan Grier is just a giant pile of broken bones holding a frying pan. And he goes, "This shit ain't over, bitch." I love it. And then they set him on fire and I guess they run away. Apparently on television, and this is really, really weird, whenever they would air this on TV and it was edited for TV, for some reason they couldn't show the charred up body in the casket.
Oh, in the casket.
So they just put the little boy in the casket.
What?
And it's like, that doesn't make sense. And that's super opposite. Depressing. Yeah. This is the most hopeful of all four stories. And you just ended it on like the saddest possible thing. It's like they burned up the monster. And then the boy just died unexpectedly. Yeah. Like, that one didn't.
You can even do the teacher. Like, you could do anybody except the little boy.
Yeah. It doesn't make a lick of sense. But,
not a lick.
Not
a
lick.
That line that you loved and, the other teacher saying, I see it. It's boy must have had weak bones.
Yeah, he's just like, I've never seen anyone fall down the stairs and break both arms and legs.
Yeah.
Like, it's just not. Yeah. He's not a good actor, but, you know, he's there to deliver two lines. He did his job. Might be my favorite of the stories, though, because that's the one I have the most nostalgia for. I remember that story most vividly. We move on to story number three, which is called KKK Comeuppance. This is fucking Puppet Master.
Yes, I actually have a line that says, "What Puppet Master is this?"
Yeah, this one I like the most. It was just fun.
Yeah, it's you know, a super blatantly racist politician living in a plantation where a lot of terrible things happened to slaves a couple hundred years ago, and people are rightfully upset and protesting. And they keep saying that the dolls are going to get him. And they do. There's a giant mural of a woman who basically, I believe what they said the legend was that after everyone was killed, she made doll bodies for them. And that's where the souls of those slaves lived. And it's got this really cool reoccurring theme of random dolls missing in the mural. And that's when they show up. And there's this fantastic reveal where he thinks that he's killed one of the dolls, and then he walks into the room, and it's just, you're following the camera as it pans past him, and the entire mural is empty now. And you're just like, oh man, shit's about to go down. But this is the one that has the least like meat on its bones. It's basically just watching this dude get his comeuppance for a good 20 minutes of just puppets just ripping him apart and biting him and attacking him and dope-ass special effects, like some shoddy stop motion that would make Chucky Band proud. Some
it
real
looks like
green
dolls.
Screen. Yeah, it's some real green screen effect going on in there. But I love it. I love a good stop motion doll movie.
Yeah, this one is the most Matt Kelly of the segments, in my opinion.
Very much so. But yeah, I
this is the thing about this. Man, I would never be able to be an actor because, as a white guy, you know, there's going to be a time in your career where they're like, hey, you need to be racist as fuck and say the N-word a bunch and then have a shit-eating smile. And I wouldn't be able to do it. Like, this movie is so hard to watch as a white person because you're like, oh, those guys still said that. I know it's acting, but they said all these horrible things. And
yeah,
and in the first story, they keep referring to the rookie cop as boy, I think. And that's such a slave thing, you know? Like, it's really...
It's weird, and I feel like the only... Because I think of, like, someone like Sam Rockwell, who's had to do this twice now in the last 2 years.
Wait, and what I did feel, Sam Rockwell do?
So there was Best of Enemies that he did, and he also did Three Billboards Outside of whatever that long title is.
Such a great movie.
Yeah, but in both of those movies, he plays like the catalyst of the racism of the South, who eventually like sees the error of his ways. And like, it's one of those things where it's like, I feel like the only way that like someone like if it was me, like the only way that I could get through it was like knowing that it's a necessary evil to tell a story that hopefully will change some other minds. You know what I mean? Like, it's like one of those things where it's like, I don't want to do this. But if like just one person who's a racist piece of shit has some type of aha moment and stops being a racist piece of shit because of this movie, then I guess it's worth it.
Okay, so that makes sense.
So we'll jump to the last story. Probably my least favorite in a lot of ways, but there's still some like really heavy moments in it.
Oh, I liked this one.
Yeah, Hardcore Convert. The scene, so it starts off with basically just a gang member pulling up and killing somebody and getting chased down by three other gang members, shot, and then the cops show up, kill the three guys who shot him. He's still alive, and they put him into like a hyper intense rehabilitation.
It's virtually the hood Captain version America. Of I was going to say the hood version of A Clockwork Orange.
Yeah, well, I was going to say okay.
I was thinking Captain America because when they strap him down and they intubate him, and then they like basically, you know, spin him around for however. I was like, this is the weirdest Captain America superhero serum I've ever seen.
No, I think Brian's right. It's definitely way more Clockwork Orange. They're forcing him to watch.
The violence.
You know,
yeah.
All right. The violence. And,
are those real? Are those real pictures?
I think so.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah,
I think so.
That is super sure. dark. That's like the most. That's the darkest part of this whole movie, I think.
Well, there's that scene with the white supremacist that they lock him up next to.
And that guy is super hard to.
Yeah. And that scene is so heavy, though. Like, yeah, that scene like, hits guys so hard.
What color were they?
And they tap into that a lot. There's so many pieces of cinematography that I really think are cool in this movie. And the one for me is they're in an elevator, and it's a weird type of industrial.
It's like the lights behind it.
Yeah, yes. It creates like a skull behind him. And it's super such cool. A – there's just – every aspect of this movie is so very clearly thought out. And that's why I still say it's probably – you know, the movie we talk about next week is the only other movie that I think comes close to being an anthology film that is from front to end so fully fleshed out and realized what it is. But yeah, this one's super heavy. He has to basically come face to face with the ghosts of anybody that he's killed intentionally and unintentionally. The little girl is a very upsetting scene.
He's like, the bullets don't have a name or something like that. Or
yeah. And basically he's given a chance to apologize and forgive himself, and he refuses. And that's when they transport him back to the very beginning of the story, and he just dies. It was like, it's depicted as, this is your chance. You can either survive this killing and change your life, or we're just going to let the killing happen. Which, again, is a very, like, Black Mirror, Twilight Zone, bleak. Yeah, Tales from the Crypt. Like, it's bleak, it's heavy. And that bleeds right into our wraparound story where the three guys that killed him are the three guys that are coming in to get the drugs, the
it's
shit.
It's in the coffins.
and then it's revealed that they did not survive the retaliation from the killings and that they are now in hell. And this is where some of the worst CGI happens.
Oh, it's so bad.
But I still love the twist. Like, I love... because, again, it's... this in the hands of literally anybody else would have completely failed. But Clarence Williams III is so over the top. Like, he is that outrageous factor that you need to make this twist work. It's like, welcome to hell, motherfuckers. So it's so good.
Second favorite way that someone says welcome to hell in a horror movie, my first favorite, is in Halloween 4 when the chubby security guard, the being, opens the door to the asylum and he goes, welcome to hell.
Yeah. He goes, he also says, this ain't no funeral home and it ain't the Terror Dome neither.
Yeah.
He's just, I'm like looking at IMDb for just some of the quotes, and he just kills it. every time. Like, he, every time I put this movie on and I see him, I'm just like, yep, I remember how much I love his performance in this movie.
I hated the ending. Like, it's, I like the idea. I like the idea of the ending. It's just, I'm not charmed by 90s special effects.
Oh no, they're not. No, listen, one is. I'm not saying that they're great. I mean, listen, the acting of these three actors who are just kind of shimmying to represent being burned.
Oh, it's so fucking great.
Yeah, like, it's not well done. Like, this is equal to the hell scene in fucking Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, which was the worst part of Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey.
I think that's upsetting to Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, and I didn't even like rewatching that for Patreon. So, Brian, do you remember a little film that you picked called Killjoy?
Yes, that was not charming either.
Oh, just remember, because I can't forget that you picked it.
Just remember, because we're never forgetting. All right, so this is the point in the show where we talk about our double features. So I'll go first, since this was my pick. And my double feature is kind of cheating. I tried to avoid other anthology films for my double features, but this one I kind of had to pick, which is 1972's Tales from the Crypt, which has almost a very similar wraparound story. It's a group of people are in a cemetery. They don't know why. They go down into a crypt, and each one of them tells a story, and at the end, it's revealed that at the end of all of the stories that they told, they died, and that they were now in the afterlife.
1972? So
just, yeah. It was the first adaptation of the EC comics.
Cool.
It's whatever. It's a Hammer film. It's as good as a Hammer.
That's the reason why I haven't seen it.
Yeah, it's all right. I probably still wouldn't have seen it had not Scream Factory put that and Vault of Horror on a double disc Blu-ray a couple years ago. Mm. And it was like both of them for like $12.99. I was like, all right.
Yeah,
I was like, all right, I'll buy that.
As much as I don't love Hammer films, they're kind of a really nice visual background.
They have a style to them that I like.
Yeah, they're boring as shit, in my opinion, but they look cool.
Yeah. All right. One of you,
I'll
guys
go next. I'm glad that you picked an anthology, because I wanted to do something that isn't a regular movie. And say a couple of the new Twilight Zone episodes would because Jordan Peele. Like, I was originally thinking, oh, like maybe Us, because, you know, we could talk about modern black excellence in film.
Yeah.
But I don't really, I mean, I liked Us, but I don't know if I would be ready to rewatch it now.
Yeah, Us is weird, because I remember when we did the episode about it, I was like, you know what? I almost think that this might be better than Get Out. But I
rewatchability
feel like
wise, I think Get Out has more. But yes, I also, I think that
say.
Get Out and Tales from the Hood would be a pretty punishing double feature as a white guy.
Fair enough, yeah. So
I would actually say, you know, pick any two episodes of the new Twilight Zone.
I'm gonna completely wash myself of it. I'm gonna wash that and be like, wow, I didn't have fun watching that because that was too heavy. But I'm going to do a good old Clarence Williams double feature, and I'm gonna put on Maniac Cop 2.
I did not think that that's what you were gonna pick when you said that, and I thought for sure you were about to watch Half Baked.
Yeah, I was like, should I say Half Baked, or I'm gonna get you, sucker? And I'm like,
I want to talk to Samson.
Climb it to the moon up above. Man, I fucking loved Half-Baked in high school.
It was such a good, good movie.
It's still infinitely quotable to me.
I don't think I'd ever rewatch it. I just think that needs to stay in the past. It's not like Super Troopers, which I could watch any day.
Yeah. Oh, Super Troopers. And that's what's so weird about those guys. I don't understand how you can accidentally make two such funny movies. And then everything
and then
else is
struggle
so bad.
With, yeah, just yeah. Struggle with every other aspect of your career.
Yeah.
Although Jay seems like, I don't know how to pronounce his last name, so I'm not going to insult him by doing it. But Jay, like, as a director of like TV shows, is really funny. He pops up on a lot of podcasting, is really funny and charming. Like, I think that he's the most naturally gifted of that group. But I think that that's also why he's the one that's broken off the most from that group and done his own thing. Yeah. Whereas like all the other guys, it's very rare that you see any of those other guys do a movie where at least one of the other people from their crew is with them. Like, I think they rely a lot on each other, where Jay can actually just be his own entity. So what did you guys watch recently or read recently or whatever that was particularly exciting? I will give mine first, which is that I am almost done reading Paperbacks from Hell, and it's a really, really great, captivating book about the fucking crazy paperback horror books that came out in the 70s and 80s.
Okay. Has Kyle read it yet?
I'm sure he has. He has to have. But yeah,
I
mean,
well, the reason why I ask is not for you guys to know, but I want to tell the listeners that go on Instagram or Etsy and Horror Finds. That's the name of
Horror Finds. They're sending me a copy of the Being on VHS any day now.
Well, most what he does is paperback horror from the 70s and 80s. And even if you don't collect that stuff, follow the account. There is some amazing cover art that he shares. I mean, and it's also our boy Kyle, so give him some support. But go ahead, continue on with what you were saying.
I mean, that's basically the worst part is the worst part about this book was that it sold well enough that there became like a collector's market for these paperback books. And now they can be very expensive.
I think that's a good thing. I don't think that's a bad thing. It's a good thing. Interesting collections.
That's true. It's just a bad thing for like my wallet when I see one of those books and I'm like, ooh, I do kind of want to read this. And then I try to find it and it's like $70 on Amazon. And I'm like, well, I don't want to read it that badly.
Well, so, if it's any consolation, you know, we all have our vices. I am still waiting to find a copy of Chopping Mall for less than $80 on VHS. Yeah. So, you know, everybody has their cross to bear, my friend.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I've got the last three Crestwood Monster books to get to have the full set. And and those last three are the most expensive ones. And that's where it's becoming difficult because it's like, I think it's $80 used for their release for Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. And I'm just like,
oh, that was a good one too.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm just not there yet. Just not there yet to buy that book.
I'm not financially stable enough to buy $80 children's book.
Exactly. One day, maybe. One day we'll sell a TV show pilot or I'll successfully make a documentary and first purchase will be that book.
So, I mean, maybe Kyle can explain to you that you don't make money making a documentary, but
but you get your foot in the door. Maybe sure. But anyway, either one of you guys go ahead next.
Well, since Scott just made that comment about not making money shooting a documentary, I think it's funny because it's true, and I will go next with Mayan. I want everyone to check out this book. It's called Bread and Bullets. It is about this guy, Rosario Leota, who he was a small-time baker, and he turned his company into like a multi-million dollar company. And he ended up getting a shakedown one day from some guy that was about to be his partner, and he shot him and killed him. And this was right before Florida passed the Stand Your Ground law. So he served 15 years in prison.
Damn.
And when it came out, like, it was kind of like, you just shot this guy, blah, blah, blah. No one really believed the fact that this guy that he feared for his life. It turned out that this guy was a mob hitman that recently killed another big business owner, and he was connected to the I think Gambino crime family. Why I'm telling you this and why I want you to read it is this guy owns a pizza shop that I go to. We just had a conversation. This came out. He gave me his book, and I'm shooting a piece on it next month.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm super excited for it.
Nice.
So, yeah.
I hate the fact that both you motherfuckers are like, these are the books that I am currently, you know, interested in telling our listeners about, and I'm like, guys, I watched Satanic Panic and I loved it. You know, like, I am a college educated adult man, and I never talk about anything literary, and I feel like a dumb shit for it.
I don't.
You do talk
really
about literary
read.
Things
yeah.
sometimes. You read comic books.
Yeah, you read.
Oh, that makes it better.
You read more than I do. I read this just because I.
Yeah, it's a
job. Because you got
him.
Some of beats.
Exactly. I need to know like what direction I want to go. So I want all the details to be like, okay, focus on this, talk about this, get shots of this.
But that's awesome. I think that that's super cool that it's that you're doing research for a passion project. But I'm just like, yeah, I watched a horror movie and I really enjoyed it.
I do like that. I didn't even think about this until Scott pointed out. We made fun of Brian so badly for how much he needed a Beats when he was in Jersey, but a Beats got him a job. So,
like, well, a job pays.
That's why I said passion project. I know. Yeah.
All right. Well, that is Tales from the Hood. I think that we did a decent enough job trying to get through something more
being
serious.
Offensive. Yeah.
Let's not try to do it again anytime soon, but I'm glad that we did it. And we will be back with our last anthology film.
And we promise Halloween. That we will make you laugh.
We will make you laugh and chuckle and all types of other things. That happen when you listen to our show, hopefully. All right, bye.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.